everyone, this is Jackie Keith with the Saturday edition of the New York Times for the 11th of April. And there's a beautiful picture of the three parachutes and the lunar module landing in the Pacific Ocean back home after a lunar loop. The Artemis II capsule splashed down on Friday after taking humans farther from Earth than ever before. And there's apparently coverage at nytimes.com. Vice President J.D. Vance traveled to Pakistan on Friday for peace talks with Iran, even as Israel strikes against Hezbollah in Lebanon, and uncertainty over the Strait of Hormuz raised questions about the durability of the ceasefire and whether the United States and Iran could reach a long-time deal. Mr. Vance said he believed the negotiations were going to be positive, but he also had a warning for Iran. If the Iranians are willing to negotiate in good faith, we're certainly willing to extend the open hand, he said before departing for Islamabad, the Pakistani capital. If they're going to try and play us, then they're going to find that the negotiating team is not that receptive. The Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, Mohammad Baghed Ghalibaf, on Friday reiterated Iran's position that negotiations with the United States could not start until there is a ceasefire in Lebanon. Mr. Ghalibaf also introduced what appeared to be a new demand for frozen Iranian assets to be released. Two of the measures mutually agreed upon between the parties have yet to be implemented: a ceasefire in Lebanon and the release of Iran's blocked assets prior to the commencement of negotiations. Mr. Ghalibaf wrote on social media, "These two matters must be fulfilled before negotiations begin." Later, the Iranian delegation led by Mr. Ghalibaf and Abbas Araghchi, the Iranian foreign minister, arrived in Islamabad to participate in the talks, Pakistan's foreign ministry said. President Trump wrote on social media that Iran was overplaying its hand in advance of the talks. The Iranians don't seem to realize they have no cards, other than a short-term extortion of the world by using international waterways, he wrote on True Social, referring to the Iran's control of the Strait of Hormuz. The only real reason they are alive today is to negotiate. Mr. Ghalibaf's demand for frozen assets was not part of a 10-point framework for peace talks that Iran released on Wednesday, a day after the ceasefire was announced. A slightly different framework published this week by Iran's state broadcaster did mention unfreezing assets, but described it as a basis for negotiations, not a prerequisite for them to begin. The State Department did not immediately respond to a request for comment on Friday, but the United States has been blocking Iranian funds. "We now know where the Iranian leadership bank accounts are," Secretary Scott Bessent said last month. "They are being frozen." While Iran has threatened to pull out of the talks if Israel does not stop its strikes in Lebanon, Israel has vowed to continue attacking Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed militant group that has been firing rockets and drones into Israel in solidarity with Tehran. On Friday, Lebanese officials said Israeli strikes in the southern Lebanese city of Nabate hit a government building and killed 13 members of Lebanese state security, one of the country's main security and intelligence agencies. An Israeli spokesman said that there had been strikes in Nabate on structures used by Hezbollah and that the military was aware of reports about harm to Lebanese security personnel, adding that the incident was under review. The Israeli military also said two of its soldiers had been injured in a drone attack in southern Lebanon. More rockets were also fired into northern Israel on Friday. Rescue workers in Lebanon's capital, Beirut, continued on Friday to clear the wreckage from a devastating series of Israeli strikes this week that killed more than 350 people, according to health officials in Lebanon. Lebanon has described the bombardment as a massacre. The Israeli military has asserted that many of the dead were militants. On Palm Sunday, in the heart of black middle-class Queens, Mayor Zoran Mandani preached the gospel of home ownership to people that are so often being pushed out. What seemed like a throwaway line and a longer address may actually have carried a far more conciliatory purpose. The mayor had angered many black homeowners by proposing to raise property taxes, and amid the ensuing uproar, Mr. Mandani all but abandoned the idea. His speech at a black church seemed designed to make amends with an important and still largely supportive voting bloc. The moment captured an important element of Mr. Mandani's rapid evolution from inexperienced state lawmaker to manager of the nation's largest city. By necessity, he was learning on the job. 100 days into his mayoralty, Mr. Mandani has hustled up a litany of quick accomplishments. He has reunited projects to improve bus speeds, built a city hall rest stop for delivery workers, opened a long-delayed new infirmary for Bikers Island detainees, secured state money to fund an incremental expansion of free preschool, and wielded the powers of his office to go after both abusive employers and bad landlords. But he has also quickly retreated from one campaign promise after another. He once vowed to relinquish unilateral control of public schools and a nod to the teachers' union. Now he supports renewing the law that established it. He had pledged to expand a rental voucher program. Now he's trying to limit its growth. Where once he called for reducing class sizes, now he is asking for more time to implement the costly mandate. The mayor has made no discernible protest towards fulfilling his vow to eliminate a police unit assigned to protests that have been known for heavy-handed tactics, nor has he followed through on his prior support for legislation to eliminate a police database of people said to be gang members. Mr. Mandani, instead, has been forced to confront an awkward reality, one easily lost in the joy of an insurgent successful campaign. As New York's first modern mayor to wholly embrace Democrat socialism, Mr. Mandani has a little actual power to impose that ideology on city government. Instead, Mr. Mandani must contend with a city council run by a more moderate speaker whom he campaigned against, a moderate governor he once openly disdained but now supports for re-election, and a Democrat electorate that extends beyond his ardent base into populations that remain wary of him, including business leaders and moderate Jews unnerved by his lifelong wholesale criticism of Israel. I always said when I was a candidate for this office that we would deliver these core central tenets by the time I was done being the mayor, and that's where we're on progress for, Mr. Mandani said in an interview on Wednesday. When asked whether his core campaign pledges of fast and free buses, universal childcare, and an income tax hike on the rich would happen this year. If New York politics are inherently rough waters, they are made only choppier by an uncertain global economy, a flagging New York City job market, and a yawning budget gap, all of which threaten Mr. Mandani's ability to afford the expansive government programs he ran on, even if Albany lawmakers supported them. It is not clear that they do. From Washington, when senior Western officials met in Ottawa last month to discuss potential terrorism threats in light of the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran, a top State Department counterterrorism official delivered an unexpected message. The United States was as concerned as always about Islamist extortion and terrorism, said the official Monica Jacobson, according to a copy of her prepared remarks reviewed by the New York Times and three officials briefed on the meeting. But she told her counterparts from Europe, Canada, and Australia the Trump administration also wanted more attention on what it believed was an insidious, underestimated threat, the far left. Western governments must combat Antifa and far-left terrorism, as Jacobson's prepared remarks asserted, casting the effort as an evolution in counterterrorism following the global war on terror. Her prepared speech defined far-left terrorism to include threats from communists, Marxists, anarchists, anti-capitalists, and those with eco-extremist and other self-identified anti-fascist ideologies. It is important to recognize their actions as political terrorism rather than mere protest or criminality, said her prepared remarks, though it was unclear if she delivered them exactly as written. As evidence, the speech pointed to left-wing protesters who had recently clashed with the police in Italy. Ms. Jacobson's appeals were part of a sweeping new effort by the White House to press foreign governments and embassies abroad to join its fight against what it calls far-left terrorists. The Trump administration is deploying its global counterterrorism machine against far-left movements like Antifa, shorthand for anti-fascist, despite offering little evidence they present a dire threat to U.S. citizens. This article is based on internal State Department documents and interviews with current and former U.S. officials, as well as officials in foreign governments that were asked to aid the effort, all of whom spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive security issues and closed meetings. The leader of the initiative is Sebastian Gorka, the senior counterterrorism director on President Trump's National Security Council. He has pushed to designate far-left groups abroad as terrorist organizations to pressure foreign allies to investigate the groups and to search for connections between them and Americans. In November, the State Department took the first major step in the strategy by designating four leftist groups in Europe, two in Greece, one in Germany, and another in Italy, as terrorist organizations. None of the groups has been known to have plotted attacks on Americans in the past decade, which is usually a criterion for such a designation. Although the designations generally impose financial restrictions, the administration could try to use them to expand the powers of the government to surveil, investigate, and prosecute left-wing activists on American soil. The administration is already targeting many activists on the left. Mr. Gorka has repeatedly told U.S. officials that there are no lone wolves, according to two officials who have witnessed the comments, in urging them to find links between left-wing extremists abroad and Americans, which could create a legal avenue to investigate U.S. citizens. From Moscow, Anastasia Busanova started learning Korean when she was 13, drawn to K-pop and the television dramas that helped make South Korea a cultural powerhouse. Now studying at a university in Moscow, she hopes to turn her hobby into a career. But in a turn reflecting the drastic change in Russia's global relations since its invasion of Ukraine in 2022, Ms. Rusanova now thinks her professional future might be tied to North Korea rather than its southern neighbor. "Our country is improving relations with North Korea," Ms. Rusanova, 21, said in an interview shortly after returning from the East Asian country as part of its exchange program. "And for me, as far as career advancement in Russia goes, North Korea seems more promising." North Korea, a totalitarian state most associated with famines, human rights abuses, and nuclear threats, has an economy 1/50th the size of South Korea's. But the Russian government sees much to like, and it has been working to promote warm feelings for North Korea among the Russian people. As the war in Ukraine has intensified Russians' isolation from the West, the Kremlin has looked east to like-minded authoritarian countries such as China and North Korea that see themselves as challenging a U.S.-led international order. Pyongyang, badly in need of allies and new sources of aid, trade, and military technology, has provided crucial support to Moscow in the war. It sent thousands of soldiers to fight in the Kursk region of Western Russia, parts of which Ukrainian forces occupied in 2024 and 25. It also sends laborers that Russia needs as it loses working-age men in war and emigration, According to an estimate that South Korean intelligence officials presented to lawmakers, up to 15,000 North Koreans were toiling in Russia as of last year. North Korea's leaders had been trying to engage Russia for decades before finally succeeding, said Fyodor Tilinsky, a Russian-born professor at Korea University in Seoul, who specializes in North Korea. They understand that they will be useless to Moscow once the war ends, and it seems like they're trying to build momentum with everything they can. For Moscow, the relationship is built on a simple fact. Putin needs ammunition for his war. Everything else is secondary, he added, referring to President Vladimir V. Putin. As it seeks to build cultural ties, Moscow is promoting exhibitions of North Korean art, tourism to the Hermetic Nation, and academic exchanges, all aimed at putting the North in a positive light. 20 years ago, Delta Airlines was giving away its best seats. Back then, only about 15% of first-class passengers paid for their seats, while most of the rest were loyal customers the airline had upgraded for free. Delta has since flipped the script. Today, it sells over 70% of those prime seats, a shift that has helped it become the most profitable airline in the United States. When you think about where the industry was 20 years ago, or where Delta was, we basically just sold main cabin seats, said Joe Esposito, Delta's chief commercial officer. He added, what we all thought back then was, can you make a premium product that people are willing to pay for? The answer has been a resounding yes. Airlines have become much better at selling those nice seats to travelers, and customers have grown much more willing to pay for them. The biggest U.S. carriers, American Airlines, Delta, and United Airlines, have invested billions of dollars to redesign their planes with more cushy seats and services. Even budget carriers like Spirit Airlines and Frontier Airlines are getting in on the action. Southwest Airlines, which for decades let passengers sit where they wanted, has no business class but recently started assigning seats in part to sell some with extra legroom. The company expects the change to increase its operating profit by more than $1 billion this year and even more next year. In the past decade, the number of premium seats on U.S. airlines has grown 69%, according to Cirium, an aviation data and research firm. The number of main economy seats, which still dominate most planes, increased 43%. The push to sell more premium seats could be risky. Competition among airlines can lead to an oversupply of seats and flights, which can hurt profits, especially during economic downturns. But American, Delta, and United are not concerned. Those airlines say they have geographic advantages and deeply loyal customers. Demand for premium seats remains high, and besides, executives said, airlines make decisions for the long term. We're not going to plan around a recessionary environment, Andrew Nocella, United's chief commercial officer, said in an interview. That happens once in a while, but it's not the norm. The definition of a premium seat is expanding too. In the past, the term was used for first or business class seats that offered more space and nicer food and drinks. Today, the best premium seats can be downright lavish, with fully flat beds, huge screens, and privacy doors. They typically come with access to airport lounges and more loyalty points than economy tickets do. But airlines have also added more options on the lower end, like premium economy cabins on international flights. Those offer better food and more comfortable seats that are wider, have more legroom, and recline further than those in regular economy. Consider a direct round-trip flight between New York and Paris a month from now. On Delta, the cheapest economy ticket runs about $1,000, premium economy costs about $3,000, and Delta One, the airline's business class seat, costs about $5,000. To flyers of a certain age, some parts of the modern premium experience were standard on major carriers not that long ago. As recently as the 1990s, American travelers enjoyed free checked bags and complimentary food. including hot meals and some domestic flights. The people who now buy premium seats often say they do so because airports and airplanes have become especially chaotic and cramped. From Washington, as the Trump administration seeks to fill a national shortage of air traffic controllers, officials are targeting a new talent pool, gamers. A Federal Aviation Administration on Friday is making a recruiting push aimed at avid players of video games as the agency strives to fill thousands of vacancies that lawmakers have said leave the traveling public less safe. In a new YouTube ad, the agency is using flashy graphics and the promise of six-figure salaries to persuade video game enthusiasts to apply their trigger fingers in service of aviation safety. In recent years, video gamers have emerged as a target demographic for recruiters at a number of federal agencies, including the military and the Department of Homeland Security. They are welcomed for their hand-eye coordination, quick decision-making in complex environments, and the ability to remain focused on screens for hours on end. To reach the next generation of air traffic controllers, we need to adapt, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said in a statement. Focusing recruiting efforts on gamers, he added, taps into a growing demographic of young adults who have many of the hard skills it takes to be a successful controller. But while air traffic experts noted gamers have potentially valuable skills, some questioned whether the focused recruiting effort will sufficiently address the agency's wider air traffic staffing problems. When you bring on someone who has gaming experience, particularly with air traffic control, they have an edge up, said Michael O'Donnell, an aerospace consultant who previously worked as a senior FAA official focused on air traffic safety. They're coming in with a skill set, but it doesn't replace aptitude or discipline or decision-making under pressure. The government has struggled for over a decade to recruit enough air traffic controllers, despite the Trump administration's effort to supercharge hiring efforts. In Mr. Duffy's words, the FAA has increased its ranks of fully certified controllers by 300 since September 2024, bringing the total number to more than 11,000 nationally. That is still thousands short of the 14,000 positions the agency said constituted full staffing in an August 2025 report. Agency officials blame a combination of attrition, the length of time that it takes to train controllers, and historically high washout rate for the slow progress. But they also claim to be making progress on those fronts that they believe in time will bear fruit. From Johannesburg, as apartheid drew to a close in South Africa in the 1990s, the activist and writer Mufundi Vundla set out to imagine what black success in the country could look like without white minority rule, a sort of roadmap toward black empowerment in the newly democratic country. The results was Generations, a television show that followed a black middle-class family in Johannesburg and relied in part on the lessons Mr. Vundla learned during his 21 years in exile in the United States. The show, which has been on air since 1994, became one of the country's foremost cultural landmarks, shifting the narrative around black South Africans from marginalization to aspiration. Yet for all the optimism that Mr. Vundla portrayed in his show, he now says that the reality he has confronted in post-apartheid South Africa has been complicated. He has struggled to come to terms with loved ones who died while he was in the United States, watched with dismay as corruption took hold in the South African government, and lamented the loss of job opportunities for young people in his home country. He was diagnosed with cancer in 2022. Those hardships have inspired Mr. Vundla's latest work, Man With No Surname, a semi-autobiographical play running in Johannesburg through Sunday. The play explores the intersecting lives of a writer returning from exile and his uncle, a doctor, who also fought against apartheid but is struggling with the guilt of having betrayed some of his fellow freedom fighters. I tell young people, you better wake up because the country is being stolen from you, Mr. Wundler said in an interview. He added that opportunities available to him when he returned from exile in 1992 were no longer available because the money is being stolen. Despite his frustration with corruption in South Africa, Mr. Wundler said he's pleased with the broad progress he's seen in the country. His play is in some ways a reflection of that journey. It's an attempt to affirm my pride as an African, triumphing against the evil of apartheid, reconnecting with home, he said. Mr. Wundler was born in the Western Native Township, a central enclave in Johannesburg, that the apartheid government had designated for black people. But Mr. Wundler's family was one of tens of thousands that were eventually removed from the area by the government and forcibly relocated to the sprawling township of Soweto outside the city. His parents had solid jobs for the time. His mother was a nurse and his father was a clerk at a gold mine. But they lived a hard life in Soweto. The family of 13 squeezed into a three-room house. It was so cramped that they had to move furniture at night to make space on the floor for everyone to sleep, Mr. Wundler said. They lived adjacent to a middle-class white neighborhood, he said, which allowed him to see the disparities of apartheid and awaken his mind to racism. With a father who was a trade unionist and official with the Liberation Party, the African National Congress, Mr. Wundler was highly engaged in the anti-apartheid struggle at a young age. While attending Fort Hare University, he disseminated banned political literature and worked as an underground organizer, activities that got him expelled from the university in the late 1960s. Emperor penguins, the world's largest and perhaps most recognizable penguin species, have joined the list of wildlife endangered by global warming, the International Union for Conservation of Nature announced on Thursday. In an update of its Red List, a comprehensive and authoritative listing of global species based on their extinction risk, the group also said that Antarctic fur seals had moved into the endangered category and that southern elephant seals had moved to vulnerable. In the case of penguins and fur seals, the changes were largely driven by shifts in sea ice levels and food availability, linked to global warming, researchers said. For species in the Antarctic region, this is the first clear evidence of climate change's influence pop up in a big way, said Kit Kovacs, the marine mammal researcher at the Norwegian Polar Institute, who leads the IUCN Seal Project. Emperor penguins. Scientists know of 66 emperor breeding colonies exclusively in Antarctica, many of which were only recently revealed by springtime satellite imagery. Images taken between 2009 and 2018 showed an overall population decline of nearly 10%. Another recent study suggested that between 2020 and 2024, seven colonies in the Ross Sea had declined by 32%. Looking further into the future, various studies project quasi-extinction in many of the colonies. Antarctic fur seals, once killed by the millions for their soft pelts, Antarctic fur seals quickly rebounded to a conservation status of least concern after a hunting ban was adopted in 1972. Since 2014, however, populations have plummeted to fewer than 1 million adults from an estimated 2 million. The magnitude and speed of this decline was surprising. Southern elephant seals are an 8,800-pound behemoth that take their name from the inflatable trunk-like proboscis that males use like a megaphone in their competition for breeding privileges with large harems of females. But this gregarious lifestyle made the species, previously listed under least concern, especially susceptible to avian influenza. For a country as small as Lebanon, the sheer scale of the crisis is staggering. More than 1 million people, roughly a fifth of the population, have been forced from their homes since a renewed war erupted last week between Israel and Hezbollah, a militia based in Lebanon. Many have nowhere to go. Schools and government buildings converted into shelters are already full. In the capital, Beirut, families sleep alongside the seafront in tents and cars, trying to stay warm. Some have found refuge with relatives. The latest round of fighting began after the US and Israel launched a war against Iran. Hezbollah militants, backed by Iran, then began firing missiles into Israel. As more people are uprooted, their presence in host communities is heightening sectarian tensions, and with Israel's attacks intensifying, the country is being pushed to its limits. From Paris, for the last several weeks, sailing a ship through the Strait of Hormuz was perilous, given the risk of Iranian attacks, whether by missiles or mines. Now that the United States and Iran have put the war on pause, the voyage may be less dangerous, but it is no less challenging politically or diplomatically. 2 days into the fragile ceasefire, the Strait has become Iran's biggest chip in a high-stakes geopolitical contest with President Trump. Rather than throwing open the waterway to oil tankers and container ships, as the Trump administration had promised, shipping analysts said Iran was keeping a chokehold on it. And Iran is giving priority to a trickle of vessels from countries that either trade directly with it or are not viewed as hostile to the Iranian government. This has put the dozens of countries that use the strait in a devilish position, having to navigate between Iran and the United States like modern-day versions of Scylla and Charybdis, the monsters of Greek mythology who threaten mariners with destruction in the treacherous Strait of Messina. The Iranians are willing to negotiate with certain countries to secure voyages, but only on a case-by-case basis, said Bridget Diakun, a senior risk and compliance analyst at Lloyd's List Intelligence, a London-based maritime data and intelligence company. The Trump administration is forcing its allies to negotiate with Iran because there's no other option. That could change if the United States applies enough pressure on Iran to ease passage in the strait. But for now, at least, the Iranians are still exploiting their ability to disrupt global trade and energy flows based on their interests. It was no coincidence, shipping analysts said, that the first Western European-owned vessel to transit the strait since Iran imposed restrictions belonged to a French shipping company, CMA CGM, and that its safe passage last week came the day after President Emmanuel Macron of France lashed out at Mr. Trump for his management of the war and for his frequent criticism of NATO alliance. France has positioned itself as not aligned with the US on the war, and so not hostile to Iran, said Martin Kelly, the head of advisory of EOS Risk Group, a consulting firm. It was probably a message for the rest of Europe. A spokeswoman for CMA CGM declined to comment on how it struck a deal with Iran. French officials said they were in touch with the company, but have not said whether the company played a role in securing the ship's passage. Other countries that have won passage for ships like Turkey, Pakistan, and India, either trade with Iran or have taken a neutral position on the war. Pakistan brokered the negotiations that resulted in the ceasefire, and it will play host to Vice President J.D. Vance and an Iranian delegation in Islamabad on Saturday, where the two sides will try to work out a permanent settlement. As talks play out, Iran is keeping a chokehold on the strait. On Wednesday, only 5 cargo ships passed through, none of which were carrying oil or gas. Iranian media said Iranian halted tankers to protest Israel's strikes on Hezbollah, the Iran-backed militant group in Lebanon. Iran, Israel, and the United States have argued over whether the ceasefire agreement includes Lebanon. On Thursday, Iran's deputy foreign minister said in an interview with ITV News that the strait was open to all, but that there were still mines in the water and that ships wanting passage needed to coordinate with the Iranian military. That could further scare shipping companies, even if they doubted the veracity of Iran's claims. From Wexford, Ireland, the Irish government promised more help on Friday for sectors affected by surging fuel prices because of the Iran war after days of wild-scale protests and blockades caused travel chaos. Highways and streets were brought to a standstill and the government had called in the army to help clear the roads. But after a meeting on Friday between government officials and union and trade groups representing farmers, truckers, and other sectors of the centre of the demonstrations, the government said in a statement that it had plans for a further financial support package to ease the strain. Discussions were expected to continue through the weekend, and no details have been released. The government had announced some measures to lower the burden last month, but the protesters said it wasn't enough. The government said in a statement that it held an emergency meeting on Thursday to discuss the demonstrations, which it said were causing significant disruption for the public to supply chains and vital services. On Friday, government officials met with more representative bodies from the agricultural, food, transport, and freight sectors for a full and frank discussion on the growing pressures, the government said in a statement. Groups of protesters began blockading roads on Tuesday with trucks and tractors, demanding the government to do more to ease the burden of fuel costs, which have jumped in price around the world since the start of the US-Israeli war with Iran. The protests appear to have been organized largely in messaging groups and on social media, with truckers, farmers, and others reliant on fuel, especially diesel, taking part. The average price of diesel in Ireland hit 2.11 euros per litre, the equivalent of more than $9.30 a gallon at the start of this week, according to data compiled by the European Commission. The price of diesel has risen over 30% since the start of the war in Iran. Now, news analysis from Michael Shear from London. As President Trump turns the United States into an increasingly grumpy, unreliable partner for Britain, Prime Minister Keir Starmer is looking to diversify his friend group. Hours after a fragile ceasefire halted the U.S. strikes on Iran this week, Mr. Starmer arrived in Saudi Arabia to begin a three-day visit to the Gulf, where he also courted leaders in the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. It was an effort, he told ITV News, to show that we stand with our allies. Only toward the end of his Middle East trip did the Prime Minister talk with Mr. Trump. That was no accident. Mr. Starmer's new approach, which follows almost a year in which he repeatedly tried to cozy up to Mr. Trump, is part of a broader strategy to move Britain closer to partners in Europe, the Middle East and elsewhere, as the relationship with the United States sours. In the 6 weeks since the Iran war started, the once chummy rapport between Mr. Starmer and Mr. Trump has cratered. In face of repeated taunts and mockery by the president, Mr. Starmer has hardened his approach, saying he will not give in to pressure from the current occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue to join the party fighting in Iran. I'm fed up, he acknowledged during Thursday's interview in a rare venting of public frustration. The Prime Minister, who rarely criticises Mr. Trump by name, complained that families and businesses in Britain were unfairly subject to wild swings in their energy bills because of the actions of Putin or Trump across the world. Asked about Mr. Trump's profanity-laced social media post last week threatening to wipe out a whole civilization, Mr. Starmer did not hesitate to distance himself from the president. Let me be really clear about this, the Prime Minister said. They are not words I would use, ever use, because I come at this with our British values and principles. Peter Ricketts, a veteran British diplomat who was the country's first national security adviser, said this week that Mr. Starmer's government needed to abandon the idea of a so-called special relationship between Britain and the United States and make deeper ties with other allies around the world. We do have to rethink the idea that the US is a reliable, trustworthy ally on which we can depend in the longer term, Mr. Ricketts said in an interview with BBC Radio. We've got to get closer to the Europeans. We've got to work out how we live in a world where American interest has moved away from Europe. He added, I don't think we can unsay the words that Trump has said about the fact that we have broken two aircraft carriers, old and useless. All this disparaging has to do damage. For his part, Mr. Starmer has made it clear that he is not giving up on closeness to the United States altogether, not least because the economic and security ties are still vital. But in recent weeks, the Prime Minister has highlighted the need to look beyond America. In Bahrain, he said that Britain's economy had struggled in the years after the Brexit vote and the subsequent deal to leave the European Union. That's why, not just on defence and security, but also on trade and energy, I want us to be closer to the EU to strengthen our economy, to make it more resilient, he said. That is politically difficult for Mr. Starmer, whose Labour Party pledged to the 2024 election campaign not to take major steps towards reversing Brexit or rejoining the European single market. But in his second year in office, he has increasingly tested the limits of that promise with steps to strengthen ties with the bloc. From Washington, weeks of harmony between President Trump and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel as they waged war against Iran is coming under strain as Mr. Trump's search for a peace deal exposes divergences between their respective long-term goals. Their differences may force Mr. Netanyahu to accept compromises on his ambitions to crush Hezbollah in Lebanon and bring down Iran's battered clerical leadership in the name of preserving relations with Mr. Trump, who appears eager to strike a deal with Tehran. Mr. Trump said on Thursday that he had asked Mr. Netanyahu to scale back Israel's military campaign in Lebanon, which threatened a two-week truce only a day after it took effect. Mr. Netanyahu cares far more about the presence of Iran-backed Hezbollah figures in Lebanon than about the Strait of Hormuz, which Iran militarized in response to the war, while Mr. Trump's overriding priority appears to be allowing oil to pass through the waterway. Mr. Netanyahu sees Iran's regime as vulnerable and would prefer not to let up military or economic pressure on Tehran. Mr. Trump appears eager to conclude a war that has spiked gas prices, troubled his supporters, and threatened his political standing. Vice President J.D. Vance is set to lead a U.S. delegation to Islamabad this weekend for talks with Iranian officials who hope to win relief from U.S. economic sanctions. Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, singled out Mr. Netanyahu in a social message video message depicting Mr. Trump's ceasefire with Iran as a farce. Israel's continued attack on Hezbollah fighters in southern Lebanon, which drew Iranian threats to negate the ceasefire deal, showed that Mr. Netanyahu continues to be outsourced leader of American foreign policy, Mr. Warner said. But Mr. Trump asserted himself in a Wednesday phone call with Mr. Netanyahu. He told NBC News on Thursday, in which he pressed the Israeli leader not to endanger the diplomacy with Iran. From Johannesburg, after President Trump demanded that Iran reopen the Strait of Hormuz in an Easter Sunday social media post, the Iranian embassy in Zimbabwe responded with a snarky quip on X, "We've lost the keys." Since the United States and Israel attacked Iran in February, the official social media accounts of several Iranian embassies and consulates around the world have made posts that went viral, matching, if not surpassing, Mr. Trump's social media bravado. The Iranian embassies in Africa appear to have taken the lead, particularly the South African account. "Say hello to the new world superpower," read a post on X by Iran's embassy in South Africa on Wednesday, the day the ceasefire between the United States, Israel, and Iran took effect. The jab was an apparent reference to Washington's failure to crush Iran's theocratic rulers, despite a far superior military. An earlier post from the embassy in South Africa played on Mr. Trump's claim to be a peacemaker, juxtaposing a cartoon dove with a shadow of a fighter jet. While other missions have shared posts on social media mocking Mr. Trump, the South African account stands out for its frequency, its ability to go viral, and because of the warm relationship between Pretoria and Tehran. From Washington, Mark Bruti, the Secretary General of NATO, described his tense meeting with President Trump this week as a conversation that was really between friends. Mr. Trump, in a social media post on Thursday, put it slightly differently. Our own very disappointing NATO does not understand anything unless they have pressure pushed upon them. Even as it has violently upended the Middle East and put intense strains on the global economy, the war in Iran has deepened the gulf between Mr. Trump and America's NATO allies. This is after those countries spent more than a year buffeted by the president's threats, begun in his first term, to abandon the alliance. Mr. Trump is training his anger as NATO, as his ceasefire with Iran hangs in the balance, and even some of his supporters question whether the United States really achieved its objectives. He is airing his discontent over his inability to take over Greenland, despite behind-the-scenes talks over the Danish island that the White House says are going well, and he is forcing European leaders yet again to try to keep him from abandoning them, even as their countries struggle to shoulder the economic cost of the U.S. war with Iran. We have sometimes the political home front to take care of, Mr. Rutte said on stage at the Ronald Reagan Institute in Washington on Thursday, in a diplomatically phrased reminder that the war was deeply unpopular in Europe. NATO is there, of course, to protect the Europeans, but also to protect the United States. Mr. Rutte, a former Prime Minister of the Netherlands, was making the point that the U.S. military benefits from its bases in Europe and, despite the tensions, has used them as staging site for the war in Iran. But widening cracks in the alliance show that even if negotiators succeed in making a deal in the talks that were to start on Saturday for a more permanent end to the war, the scars are likely to be lasting. The ceasefire that Iran and the United States announced this week opens a window to resume talks on ending the war in Ukraine. But that window will soon close, President Volodymyr Zelensky said in comments made public by his office on Thursday. Talks on the fighting in Ukraine have been underway for more than a year with little to show for them, except for brief ceasefires last year. The negotiations stalled last month after their host, the United Arab Emirates, was hit by Iranian airstrikes. Iran struck targets in the Emirates and other Gulf state nations as part of its response to attacks by Israel and the United States. Late on Thursday, President Vladimir V. Putin of Russia announced a two-day ceasefire to coincide with the Orthodox Easter holiday. Mr. Zelensky has called for an Easter ceasefire for more than a week. Asked by reporters on a messaging app, his spokesman did not immediately respond to questions about whether Ukraine would abide by a truce. Mr. Zelensky, in comments to reporters on Wednesday, said any new Ukrainian talks would have to make headway before summer, when campaigning starts in earnest for midterm elections in the United States. The United States will become even more focused on its internal processes, Mr. Zelensky said. He spoke under the condition that his remarks would not be published until his office gave permission, which it did on Thursday. From Bogota, Colombia, the Venezuelan National Assembly on Thursday approved a new law meant to modernize the country's decrepit mining industry and lure private companies to excavate Venezuela's untapped riches of gold and critical minerals. The sweeping changes in a socialist-led country that had long exerted state control over its mines are the latest example of the Venezuelan government's compliance with the Trump administration since the United States captured the country's leader, Nicolas Maduro, in January. The Venezuelan legislature, controlled by Mr. Maduro's ruling Socialist Party, passed the new law 1 month after the U.S. Interior Minister, Doug Gergen, brought dozens of American mining executives to meet with the country's acting president, Delcy Rodriguez. Both officials vowed to open Venezuela's coveted deposits to American investment. The proposal passed by a unanimous vote. The measure next goes to Ms. Rodriguez for final approval. Venezuela sits on a mineral fortune that remains largely untapped. The country is believed to have one of the largest gold reserves in the world. It is also thought to hold rare earths and vast reserves of bauxite, iron, and coal, plus copper, nickel, and coltan, a black ore used in the manufacture of items such as smartphones and satellites. Venezuelan and American officials welcomed the new legislation, saying it would help diversify the economy's reliance on oil and improve conditions for foreign companies to invest. It is similar to a law passed in late January to overhaul the oil sector. Ms. Rodriguez told about 50 investors who visited the capital, Caracas, last month that the new oil and mining laws were meant to ensure investors had guarantees, had judicial security, had political security, stability, and tranquility, so your investments could grow wildly. From San Francisco, when people make deals on the sidewalks in San Francisco's Tenderloin neighborhood, they often sell drugs for cash. But this spring, some engaged in a different trade, offering cash for signatures to help initiatives qualify for the ballot. On one afternoon this month, three men in ski masks set up a folding table in a part of San Francisco known for homelessness and addiction and handed out $5 bills and pizza slices in exchange for signatures. On one block of Leavenworth Street, people in tattered clothes sat on the sidewalk, some smoking drugs, others nodding off. Some who gathered to sign petitions clutched drug paraphernalia in one hand and a pen in the other. In a California ballot initiative season flush with cash, paid petitioners could make as much as $15 per signature. Prices are sky high, largely because a proposed billionaire's tax has spurred countermeasures funded by billionaires, and various campaigns have entered a veritable bidding war for John Hancock's across the state. While petitioners can legally earn money for convincing California voters to sign, it is illegal to pay signatories, and election officials are supposed to reject signatures that are forged or don't belong to a registered voter. Evan Underwood walked up Leavenworth after signing a petition at the table. Mr. Underwood, who said he is homeless, explained in an interview that he had signed the petition just for the cash and food. He said the men had told him what the measure was for, but he had already forgotten. Mr. Underwood, 32, is registered to vote in San Francisco, according to voting records. The signature gatherers had clipboards and a crate with petitions for a measure that would require government audits of proposed taxes and could block the millionaire's tax. Building a Better California, a group backing the measure, has received at least $45 million from the Google co-founder Sergey Brin and several million dollars from the venture capitalists John Doerr and Michael Morris, among others. And the American system of voting by mail can, like flannel and grunge rock, trace its roots to the 1990s Pacific Northwest, where Washington and Oregon moved to adopt mail-in balloting as the statewide default, driven in part by Republicans hoping to improve turnout among rural populations. But like so much in contemporary politics, what was once bipartisan has broken down into familiar battle lines, as Mr. President Trump declares war on voting by mail. Now, even where mail-in balloting has become as much a part of the culture as artisan coffee and eschewing umbrellas, officials are worried that a three-decade-old tradition is already fraying under pressure from the president, his government, and his followers. Former Vice President Kamala Harris, the 2024 Democrat nominee for president on Friday, offered some of her most detailed remarks to date about her future political ambitions, acknowledging that she was thinking about seeking the presidency in 2028. "I might," she told the Reverend Al Sharpton at a New York City gathering of the National Action Network, a civil rights organization he founded. I served for 4 years, being a heartbeat away from the presidency of the United States. I spent countless hours in my West Wing office, footsteps away from the Oval Office. I spent countless hours in the Oval Office and the Situation Room. I know what the job is, and I know what it requires. Ms. Harris's loss to President Trump in 2024 devastated Democrats, and many are now clamoring for a new generation of leadership. But inside a room full of black leaders and activists, a beaming Ms. Harris, who was the first black woman to win a major party's nomination, received an often raucous reception as she laced into Mr. Trump's stewardship of the economy and international affairs. And that's all for this week's New York Times. This is Jackie Keefe. Thank you very much for joining me. I'll see you again next time.